Well, let's return to John chapter 21 this morning. John chapter 21. So good to see Hope Walker back with us. And Hope, we were really praying for you. And think about losing both of your parents, one, two, just like that. But they were believers and just really wonderful to consider their home going. So we'll just keep praying for Hope. John chapter 21. As we approach John 21, let's recall John's emphasis on individuals. In Matthew's gospel, the author emphasized Jesus' public preaching, the Sermon on the Mount, the kingdom parables, the Olivet Discourse. But in John's gospel, you recall that John has focused our attention on Jesus' one-on-one discipleship ministry. We overheard a very long conversation between Jesus and Nicodemus, and between the woman at the well and Jesus in John chapter 4. In the previous chapter, we heard Jesus deal specifically with Mary and then with Thomas. So true to form, John now relates the story of Jesus' restoration of Peter after his threefold denial. Three times, Jesus will ask Peter whether he loves him. And three times, Jesus will recommission Peter to feed his sheep. So let's pick up the story with verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hand, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." Well, what does that mean? I'll keep reading. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, "Follow me." Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who also had leaned back against him during the supper and had said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So the saying spread abroad among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" The story of Peter's restoration is one of the most celebrated stories in all the Gospels. And yet, its interpretation is not so easy as you might first imagine. In 1970, the young historian David Hackett Fisher published a very important work called Historians' Fallacies, Toward a Logic of Historical Thought. Fisher identified numerous logical fallacies that historians make in their quest to rediscover the past. And he offered illustrations. The running joke about the book was that upon the publication, every professional historian rushed to purchase a copy and turned immediately to the index, hoping not to find his name. Who wants to be included in a book called Historians' Fallacies? Well, Fisher's book actually influenced the highly regarded New Testament scholar D.A. Carson to do something very similar with the publication of a book in 1996 called Exegetical fallacies. And the book explores various ways interpreters have, in fact, misinterpreted the scriptures. So how would you like to find yourself in the index of a book called Exegetical Fallacies? Well, one of Carson's examples actually comes from John chapter 21. And it concerns how the church has misunderstood Jesus' teaching on love. Much has been made about the term agape in Christian circles. Agape, one of the Greek words for love, is said to be a kind of really special, spirit-born, Christ-centered love that can only characterize true Christians. Much has been made of a supposed distinction between agape and phileo, another word for love. Phileo is said to be a lesser kind of love that characterizes morally upright people but doesn't quite rise to the level of agape Christian love. And supposedly, Jesus introduces a new love in this passage with a new term, the term agape. But friends, that is actually a mistake. In fact, Jesus already introduced a new kind of love back in the upper room. He gave us the new commandment. Here's what he said: love one another just as I have loved you. The power of Christian love is not found in a word, but in the model of Jesus Christ. So with that in mind, let's engage our passage. In our account, Jesus has just finished breakfast with his former disciples as if it's a mundane affair. The mighty conqueror of death turns up on the shoreline and lights a charcoal fire and cooks fish. And then he simply resumes his discipleship of the 11, where he left off in the upper room just a few days earlier. But Jesus knows that he must deal specifically with the bold but tempestuous fishermen whom he has selected to lead his little band of disciples forward and to launch his church into the wider sea of humanity. Peter is still smarting over his earlier denial of Jesus just a few days earlier. He has claimed that he would never forsake Jesus. Only the same night, he denied him three times. All four Gospels record something of Peter's collapse when Jesus was arrested and hauled in before the Sanhedrin. Luke's Gospel relates that what happened at the precise moment was this: Jesus turned and he looked at Peter. And that look is the final recorded interaction between Peter and Jesus before the crucifixion. Jesus simply looked at him. And that single gaze, I suspect, haunted Peter the rest of his life. Can you imagine vehemently betraying Jesus three times, and then he turns and he looks at you and doesn't say a word? Friends, this unnerving tension calls for a resolution. And that's why Jesus takes a walk with Peter along the shoreline. The serenity of this moment was doubtless cherished by him for the remainder of his life. Now in our text, verse 15, breakfast transitions immediately into a conversation with Peter. However, in verse 20, we learn that Peter and Jesus were actually walking. John was following along behind. So Jesus has clearly isolated Peter from the crowd. And Jesus' tactfulness should not go unnoticed. Peter publicly proclaimed that he would not deny the Lord, even if all the other disciples just fell away. I'm not going to do that. His proclamation was an assertion of his superiority over the others. It undermined the other disciples' commitment to Jesus, and it set up Peter for a spectacular fall. So how then should Jesus deal with Peter? Should he isolate Peter? Or should he deal with him publicly before the other disciples? It's a hard choice. But if he deals with him publicly, wouldn't that unnecessarily shame him? He's already broken. Then again, should Jesus fail to let Peter's public shaming of the others go unredressed? Before he assumes a very important role in the church, we need to know that Peter has been restored. So Jesus needs to communicate to the others that, yes, indeed, I have restored Peter, but he doesn't want to humble him further. So Jesus wisely extracts Peter from the public group and commences a private conversation, there we go, as they walk along the beach. It would have been perfectly obvious to anyone standing by what Jesus was doing. But Peter at the same time was spared the embarrassment of a public confrontation. Jesus is very wise, is he not? Very astute. Sometimes as a parent, you know you have to isolate one child from the others in a way that the other siblings know, okay, this child's being dealt with, but you don't deal with it publicly. That's what Jesus is doing. So in that context, let's consider two major interpretational issues where the passage is often misunderstood. First, look at verse 15. Jesus says, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" To what or whom does the term "these" refer? At least three answers have been given. The first and the most popular answer is that "these" refers to the great catch of fish that they just hauled in. That was earlier in the chapter. In this sense, fish is a kind of synecdoche, where a part represents the whole. The fish represent Peter's erstwhile vocation as a fisherman. So Jesus is saying something like, "Do you intend to return to the fish, to your old vocation as a fisherman? Or will you come and become a true fisher of men?" And friends, that is the most popular interpretation, but I think it is the least likely. The problems are three. First, if "these" refers to fish or fishing, then why does Jesus fail to address the other disciples who have likewise stumbled back into their old ways? Peter was not the only one who went fishing. So why isolate Peter from the other disciples to deal with his problem if in fact they all have the same problem? Second, if Jesus and Peter have taken a walk down the beach, the fish have now receded from view. One can imagine Jesus pointing to the fish and saying, "Do you love me more than these?" had the fish still been there, but Jesus has now left. And third, the Bible is not so antagonistic to fishing or other vocations as we sometimes imagine. And we explored this truth 2 weeks ago, so we'll not work back through that this morning. But just recall that Peter and the others have to eat. We shouldn't imagine that Jesus is forbidding all future fishing. As image bearers, we were commissioned by God from the beginning to exercise dominion over the fish of the sea. So Jesus is not, in my view, making a distinction between the ordinary vocation of fishing and the superior vocation of fishing for men. And again, we dealt with that 2 weeks ago. So here's a second possible interpretation. "Peter, do you love me more than these disciples?" That is to say, do you love me more than you love your fishing buddies? But this interpretation also seems rather unlikely. Nothing in Peter's life seems to call into question his greater love for Jesus, even if he did falter. And further, nothing suggests that Jesus was overly concerned about competing with his disciples for their affections. Jesus, in fact, commanded us to love another even as we love him. So here's a third possible interpretation. Peter, do you love me more than these disciples do? In other words, do you think your love for me is greater than other people's love or than the other disciples' love for me? Now, while it's not definitive, I think this interpretation is the most likely. Days earlier, you recall that Peter had boasted that even if the others forsook him, he never would. Peter assumed that he actually had a greater love for Jesus than the rest. It was precisely Peter's assertion of his superior commitment to Jesus that actually brought about his spectacular downfall. Would you listen to what Matthew's account says of Peter? Jesus said, "You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." So here's Peter. Peter answered him, though they all fall away, other disciples, because of you, I will never fall away. Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night before the rooster crows, you, Peter, will deny me three times." Peter assumes the superiority of his commitment to Jesus over against these others. And that's when Jesus predicted his threefold denial. "No, Peter, your commitment to me is no greater than anyone else's." And I suspect that Jesus has this earlier conversation in mind when he asked, "Do you love me more than these? Do you really think you love me more than the other disciples, Peter?" He's not asking, "Do you love me more than these fish?" Of course Peter loved them more than the fish. That was never in doubt. He's asking, "Do you love me more than these other disciples do?" Now, assuming this earlier conversation is in view back in the upper room, we have an explanation for Jesus' threefold question. Three times Jesus asks, "Do you love me?" And Jesus gives Peter a threefold opportunity to reaffirm his love for Jesus, where he had earlier denied Jesus three times. You've got three, three, and three. Now, friends, just briefly, we'll come back to this. Don't miss the obvious application. Jesus will soon promote Peter as the lead apostle. But if Jesus promotes you to a position of leadership, don't assume it's because you have superior love for Jesus than everyone else. This is really a particular lesson for the preacher, or for every elder, or for every person called to any kind of ministry. Don't ever assume your love for Jesus is superior to everyone else's. And friends, don't assume our church's love for Jesus is superior to every other church out there. This will set us up for a spectacular fall. Now, that's the first issue. Let's turn our attention now to the second issue. And it concerns the interpretation of the word love. What does the word love here mean in our passage? In Greek, as in many other languages, there are certain words that have overlapping meanings. For example, if I say that I am going to go out for a run, I can just as easily mean that I'm going to go out for a jog. Same thing. The words run and jog, not identical, can be used synonymously. Now, run could mean jog. It could also mean sprint. Sprint typically doesn't mean jog, and jog doesn't mean sprint. But there is an overlapping intersection of meaning here between run and jog. So often in Greek, writers, as in every language, will use synonyms if for no other reason than stylistic variation. Ask an English teacher, right, Kelly? You want some variety of words. This is good English, right? I could describe someone as smart, intelligent, bright, astute, or brainy, all with precisely the same meaning. I can refer to my house, home, or residence with the same meaning. Now, in Greek, there are several terms for love. Two different Greek terms for love show up right here in our passage. But are they used interchangeably for stylistic purposes, stylistic variation, or do they actually refer to different kinds of love? That's the popular interpretation, but is it the right interpretation? Well, let's read the passage and let's note the differences. All right, verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love?" And that's the word from which we get our word agape. "Do you agape me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love phileo." Different word, "I phileo you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you agape me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you phileo me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you phileo me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I phileo you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." So twice, Jesus asked Peter whether he loved agape him. To which Peter twice responded, "Yes, I phileo you." The third time, Jesus asked whether Peter phileo him. To which Peter responded, "Yes, I phileo you." Now, many have suggested that Jesus was calling for a new special kind of love, agape love, in those first two appeals. However, when Peter could not bring himself to admit his agape love, he responded instead with a weaker term, phileo. Jesus, therefore, conceded to Peter's weaker love, and he lowered the standard and asked him whether he phileo him, to which Peter again affirmed that he had phileo love. So according to a widely held interpretation, Jesus was introducing here agape love, but it did not yet characterize Peter. Agape, then, is said to be a kind of supreme Christian love that Jesus is right here introducing as the new ideal for all future disciples, and that hopefully one day Peter will reach. We all need to move beyond simple phileo love and embrace true agape love. And I'm guessing that the majority of us have heard the passage preached this way. And it does preach rather well. But is that what the passage teaches? Or is it merely a matter of stylistic variation? Well, here's a very trite illustration, but I think it'll make the point. Imagine Jesus at breakfast saying, "Peter, would you like to go out for a run on the beach?" Peter responds, "Sure, I need to get out for a jog. Let me go find my running shoes." Jesus asks a second time, "Peter, are we going to go for a run?" Peter responds, "Yes, give me a moment for the fish to settle and I'll go out for a jog. And don't run on fish, it's really bad." All right? A third time, Jesus says, "Peter, are you ready to go for a jog on the beach?" And Peter responds, "Yes, let's go for a jog." If you overheard that conversation, all right, would you try to microanalyze it to make some critical distinction between running and jogging? Probably not. You would simply recognize the synonyms running and jogging refer to the same activity. More than likely, Jesus and Peter use agape and phileo in the same way. They are simply synonyms in our text. Almost certainly, Jesus is not introducing agape as some sort of special new term to distinguish Christian love from every other kind of love. And let me give you five reasons why I think that's the case. All right, here we go. Would you turn back, first of all, to John chapter 3, and also put a finger in John chapter 5. John 3 and John 5. And while you turn, let me give you the most academic reason. There was an older school of thought that suggested the translators of the Septuagint, that is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, invented the term agape to be used in the Scriptures to describe a special kind of love. The term then came over into the New Testament to define true Christian love. And Jesus picked up on that Septuagint term and tried to introduce it here as the term to be used for true Christian love. The trouble is, more recent scholarship has shown that the term agape was actually fairly widespread in Greek literature as early as the 4th century B.C. You're talking 400 years before Jesus. The term is already being used. It was not invented for biblical purposes. In fact, in the Septuagint, the terms agape and phileo are used interchangeably as synonymous terms. Second, Jesus himself has already used the terms phileo and agape interchangeably in John's Gospel. Would you look at John 3 and verse 35? John 3, 35, Jesus declared to Nicodemus, "The Father loves the Son and has given all things into His hand." Here the term is agape. Now look at John 5 and verse 20. Jesus later says to the Jews, "For the Father loves the Son and shows Him all that He is doing." Here the term is phileo. So are we to assume that in one case the Father has a superior Christian love for the Son, agape, but in the other He exercises a lesser love for the Son, phileo? No, the terms are used synonymously. Interchangeably, yes, but synonymously. In John 11, verse 5, and also verse 36, both terms are used to describe Jesus' love for Lazarus. So John has already been using these terms as synonymous terms. And with that in mind, let's turn back to John 21, and let me give you a third reason. And that is that John often uses synonyms for the sake of stylistic variety. And in fact, in our very context right here in Greek, John actually uses three different expressions for caring for the sheep. In verses 15 through 16, our ESV picks up on two of those three Greek differences, those three Greek terms. The ESV has "feeding my sheep" and "tending my sheep." All right? Are we to assume there's some sort of major interpretational difference here because a different word is used? Or is this just simple stylistic variation? Is it running and jogging? I suspect that's all there is to it. Fourthly, later in the New Testament, the term agape is not, in fact, used exclusively for some sort of special Christian love. It is used, for example, in 2 Timothy 4, verse 10, to describe a man named Demas. Demas, Paul says, forsook him. Why? Here's why. Because he loved agape, this present world. According to Paul, one can agape the world. And fifthly, would you consider Peter's final unvarnished response in verse 17? He said in the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. Search my heart. You know that I love you. Does Peter's response suggest that he is playing word games with Jesus and trying to avoid a direct answer to Jesus' searching question? I don't think so. Does it suggest that he's trying to avoid one term by using another? I don't think so. Peter is full of emotion and brokenness, and he just lays his heart bare before the Lord. Search it out entirely. So those five considerations suggest that we need to do something else with the passage rather than viewing it as an introduction to a new Christian term for love, agape. In fact, the passage does not concern the introduction of a new kind of love at all. It concerns Peter's restoration. Jesus once again already introduced a new kind of love back in the upper room. If you want to understand Christian love, don't play semantic games with a Greek word, agape. Just remember what Jesus said. A new commandment I give to you. Here's the new commandment, that you love one another. But how? Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. Christians can talk rather piously about their agape love. Oh, I agape you and I agape this. But friends, what matters is not a fancy Greek term. What really matters is that you model the love of Jesus for one another. That's what matters. So what then is the message of the passage? Well, let's assume that these refers to the other disciples. Jesus asked Peter, do you really love me more than these other disciples love me? Well, Peter thought so, but in the upper room he failed just like the rest of them. And Jesus is interested in restoring Peter. So how does he restore Peter? Well, three times Jesus just refocused Peter's love, pointing it back to himself, and encouraged him to demonstrate that love through service. Go feed my sheep. Peter had been self-absorbed in reflection about his superiority over the other disciples. And Jesus essentially says, just forget about all that, Peter. Just love me. Recalibrate your affections on me. Quit comparing yourself to others. Love me. And demonstrate that by feeding my sheep. Simply put, stop asserting your superiority over the others. And serve me by serving others. And remember, Jesus stooped to wash the disciples' feet. And that's when he delivered the new commandment. Love one another just as I have loved you. That was the lesson that Peter missed. And this, I think, is the lesson that fundamentalism failed to learn and which brought about its death. It was too busy asserting its superiority over everyone else, and it lost sight of its mission. That can happen to a church. That can happen to a pastor. That can happen to a school. That can happen to a whole movement. So what does Peter need to learn? Your love for me is not greater than anyone else's, Jesus says. Well, did Peter learn the lesson? Would you consider the future of the church? Did Peter go out and serve others? Emphatically, yes. In fact, Peter laid down his own life for the sake of Christ's church. That's what verses 18 through 19 concern. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. Contextually, that's a rather abrupt and confusing illustration. On the one hand, it could refer to elderly people needing help from others, even with small tasks. But in this case, John gives us the further explanation, verse 19. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, "Follow me." Well, tradition has it that Peter was crucified. Some traditions suggest that he was crucified upside down, feeling unworthy to die like his master. These are probably apocryphal. But almost certainly, Peter suffered martyrdom under Nero, and he suffered by way of crucifixion. In this sense, his hands were stretched out against his will. Verse 18 could also refer to his being stretched out for a public flogging. We really can't say for certain. But what we can say is that Peter did indeed follow Christ for more than 3 decades with this dreadful prophecy hanging over his head. Peter was restored and he served the body of Christ to the point of martyrdom. That was the point. Don't compare yourselves to others. Serve others. Don't assume you love Jesus more than everyone else. Don't assume your position means you love Jesus more than everyone else. Just serve others. And in conclusion, would you turn to 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8? 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8. And I just want Peter to give us the final word this morning, the final word of application. Days earlier, when Jesus stooped to wash the disciples' feet, Peter did not understand Jesus' gesture. In fact, all the disciples had been engaged in the upper room in a petty dispute over who would be greatest in the kingdom. And Peter, in the upper room, claimed the upper hand. "Though they all fall away, Jesus, I will never fall away. He's the superior one." And of course, he failed. But was he restored? Peter finally learned the meaning of Jesus' foot washing. And here is what he recorded in his epistle. This is the application. 1 Peter 4, verse 8. "Above all, keep loving one another earnestly." Just keep doing it. "Since love covers a multitude of sins." Verse 9, "Show hospitality to one another without grumbling." Verse 10, "As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace." Verse 11, "Whoever speaks as one who speaks oracles of God, whoever serves as one who serves by the strength that God supplies, in order that in everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. To Him belong glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen." Clearly, Peter learned the lesson. Stop comparing yourself to others and start serving